Well, as if you need telling, that's the Beatles and Paperback Writer here on Phoenix FM. And there's a very specific reason I'm playing that particular record, because I've got with me Brian Southall. Good afternoon, Brian.
Afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon to you. Now, I know you're not specifically a paperback writer, but some of your books have been put out in paperback form. But I guess I better do a bit of an introduction to you, I suppose. Right?
Go on, then.
Okay, this is quite long. Brian Southall began his working life interviewing pop groups as a journalist on the Essex Chronicle back in the 1960s. He's had jobs at Music Business Weekly, Melody Maker and Disc before he joined A&M Records as a press officer. Then a 15-year career at EMI Records in press, promotion, marketing, artist development and corporate communications enabled him to work with the likes of Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Queen, Cliff Richard, Pink Floyd, the Sex Pistols, Kate Bush, Nigel Kennedy and the Rolling Stones. That's quite a cast list, isn't it, really? From 1989, he was consultant to Warner Music International, the international music retailers HMV, and both the British Phonographic Industry and the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry. Well, with a CV like that, I'm truly delighted to welcome Brian Southall to the studio today. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Bob. It's my pleasure.
Great to have you here. Now, nowadays, of course, you're an author with a string of titles to your name, including The Official History of Abbey Road Studios, The Story of Northern Songs, The Dark Side of the Moon Revealed, The Real Story of Pink Floyd's Landmark Album, Treasures of Bob Dylan, Simply Red, The Official Story, Treasures of the Bee Gees, and Jimi Hendrix, Made in England, and the list goes on. Do you ever rest, man?
I quite like writing books. People seem to keep asking me to write books. It's an arrogant thing to say, and it's not meant arrogantly. The easiest thing about writing books is writing books. The worst thing is research and interviewing people because you've got to transcribe it all and do all that. So the actual physical sitting down writing 100,000 words, I don't find particularly difficult.
Right. Now, you've written a new book entitled Band on the Run. That's band as in B-A-N-N-E.
It's a play on words.
Yes, like absolutely. And we'll come on to that in a moment. Yep. But myself, as a lifelong Beatles fan, I'm itching to hear about your work at EMI and your history of Abbey Road Studios. Tell us a bit about how you got involved in all of that.
Well, it's, as you said, I started on the Essex Chronicle in 1964 or 5, I suppose, when I left school. My father was a journalist, so that was the way in for me. And we decided that we thought we might get some free records, so we started the pop column. And we did get a lot of free records. It was good. So we did all that. And then as bands were touring around the 60s and visiting the Corn Exchange in Chelmsford and were package tours, we thought we'd go and interview a few.
Okay.
So I went down to the Corn Exchange in Chelmsford and interviewed the Who, the Animals, Zoot Money,
bands like those.
And the Rolling Stones at Southend Odeon, in fact. But the first band I interviewed were the Who at Chelmsford Corn Exchange, and they gave me a word. I've still got a copy of it. Actually, somebody sent it to me. Someone found it on a website somewhere and sent me the article that I'd written, which was my interview with the Who, where they told me exclusively. In 1965, I think, they were going to break up. And I'm looking back now in 2014 thinking, two are dead and they're going.
Still at it, yeah.
So that was a world exclusive for me.
Right. Did they give a reason for that at the time?
They just thought they'd get bored. It was a very weird experience. I went, if anyone remembers the old Corn Exchange, the dressing room for The Who was upstairs. Most of them had a dressing room at the back.
Right.
The Who, because I presume they were famous, or they were, I don't know, they had a dressing room upstairs, which used to be the sort of ballroom area.
Right.
And I went up there to see them after the performance, which was quite extraordinary and very robust. And up there in this room, there were the four members of the band, a lot of young ladies who I later came to know were groupies.
Okay.
I don't know what they were. But anyway, ladies of a certain age in a certain sense of dress. And an awful lot of booze and some substances that we probably shouldn't talk about.
Right, okay.
And then the manager came in, and I can't remember whether it was actually Chris Stamp, because he was Terry Stamp's brother, who was their manager, or Kit Lambert. But one of them came in with a suitcase, opened it up, and it was full of cash. And those were the takings which he shared out to the band. And I thought, hang on, money, drink, drugs, girls, rock and roll. I could do this. Even if I can't play an instrument, I can do this. And that sort of set me off, and I went to see interview the Rolling Stones. And then eventually I sort of became a sports editor in Braintree and in Surrey. And then I eventually got a job on a trade paper called Music Business Weekly in 1969. Right. And from there I was in the music industry, and that was it.
Okay, you know. And later you joined EMI. When was that?
Joined EMI on April Fool's Day.
Oh, right.
It took him 15 years to realise it was a joke. April the 1st, 1974, I joined, okay. Having been at A&M and worked with the Carpenters. Toured with the Carpenters for 3 weeks around the UK. We had to go to two shows a night, and we had to go to every show.
Right.
The manager insisted.
Okay.
So we were trying to. We had influenza. We had all sorts of diseases just to get out and not go, because I hated the Carpenters.
Oh, right.
I hated their music. Lovely people. Karen was a bit strange, but we won't go down that route.
Okay.
And then I joined EMI working as press officer for Motown Records, because Motown was licensed through EMI in those days. Yep. And I joined because I used to write about soul music on disc and stuff like that. So I joined looking after, you know, Stevie Wonder, the Commodores and Dinah Ross and all that lot when they came to England, and setting up phone interviews and stuff like that, which was sort of fun. I remember being in a hotel room with Stevie Wonder when he asked me to go and adjust the television and turn the television on.
Right.
And adjust it. And I went, okay. And I got up and went, and I thought, hang on, you're blind. Why am I doing this? Have I just discovered that Stevie Wonder is not blind?
Right.
And he loved watching the television.
Really?
He had
some vision.
It sort
I guess.
Of got. Yeah. No, he had no vision at all. But it was getting whatever you get off ultraviolet something.
Okay.
He got something. He loved watching. He always had the television on. And I thought, hang on, I've sussed this. And I remember trying to get him through the doors of Manchester Square, which were glass, and trying very deliberately to get him into the doors, and I walked into a glass door, and he said, "Hey, I'm the blind one, not you." It was very funny, it was actually a great guy, Stevie Wonder. We had great fun with him, and you know, and the Four Tops and the Commodores, and you know, Miss Ross, as we had to call her.
Oh, I see. Yes,
Miss Ross,
yes,
which was sort of fun.
Diva Diana, yes.
Yeah, and then I joined. Within EMI, I moved to be head of press for the EMI division,
right,
which involved me working with the acts signed directly to EMI, which at that time were the individual Beatles, Pink Floyd, Queen, Cliff Richard, Olivia Newton-John, a long list. And then we signed the Sex Pistols, and I was their press officer for 90 days, which was sort of fun.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Kate Bush, and whatever went on after.
Well, tell us about the Sex Pistols. Were you sort of lurking in the background when Bill Grundy interviewed them?
No, it wasn't. Actually, that was a radio thing, because I was the head of press. So it was set up by Eric Hall.
Our very own Eric Hall. He presents the show here on Saturdays.
Oh, well, God bless him. Yeah. Lovely Eric. Monster.
Yes.
I was head of press and Eric was head of radio. And he'll tell you the story.
Right.
It was supposed to be a Queen video was on the or Queen were on the show. Anyway, it didn't happen for whatever reason. So the Pistols were put in at the last minute on this program called the Today program.
Yes,
They didn't know what it was.
Right.
And Bill Grundy had no idea who they were. And this mob turned up.
Okay.
Malcolm thought it was hilarious to do this sort of show, and he brought a bunch of people with him.
Right.
Susie of Susie and the Banshees. It was their fan club.
Right.
So that all these people sort of descended on the studio. And it turned into sort of chaos. I mean, Bill Grundy did encourage them to swear, they did.
Yes, I think he taunted them.
Which they thought, they thought was fun. And then, of course, we had the fallout because they were signed to EMI, which was a corporation, you know, shares were on the stock exchange. And questions in the House, prime ministers, letters from all sorts of people who objected to...
Oh, it was a big thing, wasn't it?
And ironically, and I mentioned in this book, Banned on Earth, the thing was that Anarchy in the UK was banned at radio.
Okay.
And there was nothing wrong with the record. They played the record
until
the band appeared on television, and then this huge reaction came to the band and their behaviour. So they stopped playing the record.
Yeah.
And there was nothing wrong with the record.
Yeah, yeah.
And I ultimately wrote a book called Sex Pistols 90 Days at EMI, because that's all we had them for.
Right.
90 days, one record. And I interviewed Glenn Matlock, who I remain sort of friendly with, because he was with the band at EMI. And Glenn wrote the foreword for me for this book, and he said if he'd been the chairman of EMI, he'd probably fired the Sex Pistols as well.
Yeah,
you know?
There
was a lot of play. Malcolm was playing the fool, and the band were playing the game with Malcolm, and they got accused of an awful lot of stuff they didn't do.
Yeah, and it kind of worked for them, didn't it?
It worked for Malcolm, that's for sure.
Right,
you know,
yeah, sure.
I mean, I think the big mistake, seriously, was employing Sid Vicious.
Okay.
I mean, Sid Vicious was a very unpleasant man.
Okay.
He wasn't with them when, at EMI, he was their roadie.
Right.
And then they fired Glenn, and Sid became, quotes, bass player. And then it all turned really nasty, because Sid could be a very nasty man.
Yeah.
Very unpleasant, a lot of drinking, a lot of violence. And then it did become seriously unwielding, and you know, A&M fired them after about a week because they wrecked the building and had punch-ups in the office.
Amazing.
Burst into the ladies' toilet. I mean, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Richard Branson took them on at Virgin.
Yes.
And you know, the album came out, and, you know,
yeah, you know. Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, Brian, I think you ought to sit this side of the desk and we'll just leave you talking for about an hour. That is, well, it's fabulously entertaining. Now, me, lifelong Beatles fan,
yeah.
I've got to hear about the guys. Now, you've worked with both Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and I hear you've met Ringo Starr.
I worked with Ringo. I was press officer at EMI when we had them all signed as solo artists.
Okay.
So the only one I never met, of course, was John, who was in America.
So
we basically, myself and other people in EMI used to communicate with John by telegram.
Okay.
He liked a telegram. the days before computers and whatever else. So telegrams did come flying. He also liked a postcard.
Oh, really?
He liked a postcard, most of which were obscene. he was very critical of what we did with his records.
Oh, okay.
And Julian has some, and I've sort of kept a couple and sold a couple, and some are locked away. But anyway, now he did like a postcard, and he did like a telegram. Mostly being critical of us. Ringo, sort of met him two or three times with his records that came through in those days. George, I was George's press officer for his last album at EMI called Extra Texture.
Okay.
And I spoke with him. He had Dark Horse Records in those days. And he agreed to do one interview, and he would do it only with Ray Coleman, who was the editor of Melody Maker, who he'd known from way back, and I, in fact, knew Ray because I worked for Ray. And Ray was by then working for... he may have left Melody Maker, he may have been working for The Mirror, I can't remember. Anyway, he would only be interviewed by Ray. So we went down to the offices to do this interview. And I remember one of the quotes was that Ray said to him, "What's it like being an ex-Beatle?"
Okay.
And his answer was, "Marginally better than being an ex-Nazi." Because George never liked being in the Beatles.
No,
he didn't.
No.
He didn't like the idea that people wouldn't listen to what he was doing and wanted to scream. So he never quite got that.
No.
But then we went back to Manchester Square, the famous EMI building where the Beatles' first album cover photograph was taken,
which has
now been knocked down, sadly. But anyway,
right.
And we parked outside, and it was me, George, and his driver, stroke minder, and we got out. And George said, "Oh, I need to go and have a pee." And I went, "Okay, I don't know what you do with the Beatles. Do you go with them? Do they do it on their own? Do you do it for them? I don't know. I've never been to the toilet with a Beatle before." So I sort of went, you know, "Are you okay?" And he said, "I'll see you upstairs." So he went off down to the toilet, which was in the lobby, and I walked up to the first floor, which is in fact where the Beatles photograph was taken, on that very landing.
Yes.
And coming from his office was the managing director of EMI Records, who was my boss.
Okay.
And he came across, I had very long hair and a beard, and he came across and shook my hand and said, and he was Dutch, which maybe explained something, and he said, "Hello, George, very pleased to meet you." And I went, and I suddenly twigged, he thought I was George Harrison.
Okay, yeah.
So I then started talking to him very loudly, because he was foreign. Okay, "Me no George." "George him wee wee." "Me Brian Southall work you." And he just looked at me and went, "Okay," and walked off.
Right.
I thought I could have got a check for some royalties very quickly. And then I went to my immediate boss, my marketing director, and said to Bob, I said to him, is Jerry Orr, this was the guy's name, the chairman and managing director, I said, "Is Jerry coming into the meeting with George?" And he said, "Yes."
Right.
He said, "Why?" He said, "Because I can't come in." He said, why not? I said, because he thinks I'm George Harrison. So there's going to be two of us in the room, one who is George Harrison and one who looks like George Harrison.
Right, okay.
And it's going to confuse the chairman.
Okay.
So we agreed that I wouldn't go in the meeting until Jerry got bored and left.
Okay.
And then we told the story to George. You thought it was absolutely hilarious.
I'm sure, yeah.
And so for a moment, I was George Harrison.
Right. You know? So, I mean, you obviously built up relationships with these big superstars over a period of time, but initially, did you find it intimidating to work with them?
Yeah, they were my heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was a record fan. I bought all their records. You know, the idea of, digressing. When I wrote a book with Mick Hucknall, which was the official history of story of Simply Red, and Mick Hucknall said, you know, we were talking about it, and he was impressed that I had met three Beatles.
Sure.
He'd only ever met one.
Right.
And it was Ringo, which is, no disrespect to Ringo, but it was Ringo.
Yep.
And he said he was absolutely petrified
of meeting
a Beatle,
Ringo,
as Mick Hucknall.
Yeah.
So, yes, it was overwhelming. And, you know, Cliff Richard was, you know, I never liked his music, but he was a legend.
Yes,
you know, and then Pink Floyd, who were just sort of weird, because they never played any sort of game. I was their press officer and didn't organise an interview for 5 years.
Really?
Because they didn't want one.
They didn't want to
do it. We didn't have a publicity photograph for 3 years. They did nothing. We played cricket against them. That's all we ever did. They had their own cricket team. EMI had a cricket team. And we played twice a year on the Bank of England cricket ground or Harrods or somewhere.
Sure.
And we played proper cricket games in whites and stuff like that.
Amazing.
And that, you know, we never got all four Pink Floyd together because they were never, ever talking to each other.
Yeah.
I think we got three at one time in a game. So, you know, you did build up, but they were always... They were never friends. You know, even
there
was a working relationship.
Yeah,
you were there to work for them, with them, however you want to put it. And after I left, I regularly got Christmas cards from Kate Bush, and I got them from Iron Maiden and from Queen and stuff like that. And Cliff, and it sort of died out over the years because I left EMI in 1989, I think.
Right.
But you know, there were. I mean, my biggest pal in the music industry was never signed to EMI. It was Phil Lynott of Thin Lizzy.
Oh, okay.
Who I interviewed when I was on Disc.
Okay.
And we remained pals up until the day he died. And he would come into EMI and nick all my records and try and pull all the secretaries that were in the building because Philip did that. But, you know, he was my closest mate because I had no working relationship with him.
Right.
You know, I mean, ironically, when I first went to America with Queen in 1977, the support act was Thin Lizzy.
Wow.
Nothing to do with me, purely coincidence. Yeah, so there I am there with Queen and my mate Philip.
Wow.
You know, and, you know, working with Freddie was just a weird experience.
Oh, really?
I mean, extraordinarily generous man in many, many ways, but, you know, I mean, just... excessive, just flamboyant beyond belief. Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you know, off stage and in a quiet moment, just a very charming man. And they were very, very bright because they were all university graduates, and they weren't your normal run of the mill rock stars. You know, they were.
Well, what a career, eh? Puts my 25 years with the post office in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah. Hey, all our records went via you. Maybe that's why they never got there.
Oh, it wasn't my fault. No. Let's talk about Abbey Road for a second. The studios there, they're legendary for Beatles, of course, and they seem like part of our musical heritage, really. But in 2011, the whole of EMI's recorded music division, including Abbey Road Studios, were sold to Universal.
Yep.
How did you feel about that?
I was fine about it. I mean, the bit in between was I wrote a book called The Rise and Fall of EMI, which was a sort of business study of EMI, focusing on... It covered the whole company, but the history, but focusing on sort of 1996 onwards, which is when it was divested from Thorn, if you like, and was the beginning of a difficult period for it. Mm. When it was acquired by Guy Hans, that's when it worried me most, because it was now in the hands of someone who... had no experience of running a record company and was perhaps in it solely for reasons of profit. You know, ultimately it was taken back by Citibank because of loan issues and bought by Universal, which is fine. I mean, it's owned by a record company. The sad thing is that there are only four record companies left in the world.
Yeah,
you know, in that Warner's, Sony, Well, only three now, because Universal have bought EMI. So there's only three major record companies left, which is a bit sad from the days when, in the 70s, there were 100 independent labels, all, you know, Island, Chrysalis, A&M, you know, all doing, you know, Motown. So that's a sort of bit sad, but at least it's with a music company. They had to divest themselves of an awful lot of stuff to get the deal through. I discovered last week from researching another book that the entire sort of Parlophone division of what was old EMI had to be sold to Warner's in order for the European Commission to approve the deal. So things like the Hollies and Jerry and the Pacemakers and Cilla Black are all no longer with EMI, their catalogue. So, but it's with a record company run by an Englishman, interestingly enough.
Okay.
So, and who has a great love for EMI. And he's a great love for Abbey Road. So I think there's nothing else you can do with it.
No, it's still a working recording studio.
Yeah, there's nothing else you can do with it. You know, I mean, you. It hasn't. It's got some preservation order on it architecturally, as a building. Yeah. But you know, there were talks about turning it into a museum, but it's in a residential street in St John's Wood.
Yeah,
they ain't going to have coaches up and down it.
No.
You know, we tried that. We opened the studios in 1986, I think, when with some work being done on Studio 2. So we did have some organised coach trips into the studio and we put on a Beatles show, you know.
Yeah.
But it caused uproar in the streets because,
you
know, it's a very expensive area of London and they didn't like buses going up and down on coaches.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, you could never turn it into a museum. The idea of turning it back to a residential house, which you could, I suppose, but you've got to, you know. So I think it will remain a studio. I mean, it primarily now does film work.
Oh, really? Oh,
which is, they have a huge Studio One, which, you know, can take an 80-piece orchestra.
Right.
And they play the film at the back of the room on a big projector, and the guys bang away on the violins doing, they did all the Harrison Ford stuff. They did Star Trek, Star Wars there. You know, it's one of the few studios where you can, in this country, where you can get 80 musicians in, you know, in a classical studio.
Yeah,
so it is alive and well, but I mean, my interest could just briefly.
Yeah, sure.
I when I did the book on Abbey Road, and I sort of spoke to Paul's office to interview him, and he said, let's do it in Abbey Road.
Right.
So
yeah,
we went, okay.
Yeah.
So I went to Abbey Road Studios to meet Paul, and he said, I tell you what. Do you mind where we do it? I said, no, it's just been done on a tape recorder, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, no. He said, let's go and do it where I used to hide.
Ah.
And they all had their individual hiding places to get rid of each other,
okay.
to get away from each other.
Okay.
And Paul's was the boiler room.
Amazing.
So we went down to the boiler room, and the boilers were on. It was baking hot. Sat on a couple of upturned beer crates and talked about Abbey Road and the Beatles being in Abbey Road, because it meant nothing to Paul and the Beatles. They'd never heard of Abbey Road.
No.
They'd never heard of EMI.
No.
They'd heard of HMV
because
they'd bought records of Johnny Kidd.
In fact, it wasn't even called Abbey Road until they brought the album Abbey Road out, was it? I don't think.
It was one of those things that was in Abbey Road and people called it Abbey Road.
Okay.
It was EMI Recording Studios, Abbey Road.
Oh, okay.
So, it was and no, it wasn't.
Yes,
it was one of those things that it was nicknamed or always referred to as Abbey Road.
Well, now, Brian, as we mentioned earlier, you've written about many legends of music, but now you've turned your attention to what I think is a fascinating subject in your latest book, Band on the Run, which is a collection of songs, record covers and artists that have caused outrage and indignation, leading to bans and in some cases arrests. So you've already heard you were the EMI press officer when they sacked the Sex Pistols in 1977, so who better to write it? But how did you come up with the idea in the first place?
I've been asked a couple of times about it, and I can't actually remember. It's something that's been in between writing other books and stuff. You have ideas and you spot things. Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. And somewhere along, and finally, I've sort of got it together and we've done it now as an e-book, which is my first ever e-book, which is sort of interesting experience.
Right.
And I've just sort of been, assembling the stories and collecting them and whatever else over the years and being surprised and amused and entertained by... going back, I think we started in 1933 and George Formby.
Yes. What's all that about?
Well, he made a record called With My Little Ukulele in My Hand, which you can, do what you like with that.
Yeah, the other one was My Little Stick of
Blackpool
Rock.
They banned My Little Ukulele, and then he then came back with My Little Stick of Blackpool Rock. And there was a note in the BBC files that said Mr. Formby seems to have some difficulty understanding the BBC. But of course, one of the things was that he was a huge musical star.
Yeah.
And these were done live in musical.
Yeah, sure.
A bit, you can go to a live show now, a rock band, and hear stuff that you'll never hear hear on the radio.
Oh, absolutely.
So he and Max Miller and all those people were doing this stuff in the music halls, and the record, you know, the BBC was the keeper of our morals and decided that they would decide, you know, not to broadcast its stuff. So, you know, it goes on through there with there's some interesting sort of weird religious ones. There was a record called 100 Pounds of Clay by Gene McDaniels in America and Craig Douglas here. And there was a sort of fundamentalist church association who objected to the idea that a woman was made from clay.
Okay.
On the basis she was made from the rib of Adam, I presume. So, you know, the BBC reacted to all these things, whether they should or they shouldn't, I don't know. And then, so it went through the 50s where there were Johnny Ray, because he grunted on such a night. And, it went through all sorts of strange records. And,
times have changed a bit, really, haven't they?
They have a bit. I mean, the interesting, some of the ones in the 60s were the BBC had a very strong policy about not mentioning the names of corporations and products.
Yes.
And two of my favourites were Mott the Hoople did a song version of All the Young Dudes by David Bowie, which has a line in it about stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks. And the BBC objected to the words Marks and Sparks as a reference to Marks and Spencers. Stealing clothes is absolutely fine, apparently. So it was reworked as stealing clothes from parked cars.
Okay. And that was all right.
Yeah. Mm. And then we got to Lola, of course, with the Kinks.
Oh, yes.
Now, in 1967, Pink Floyd had made Arnold Lane, which was a record about a transvestite.
About cross-dressing.
And BBC played it, but Radio London wouldn't.
Right.
They thought it was smutty. Right. So there was this record about... And then the Kinks came up in 1970 with Lola, which was obviously about a young man going to a club in Soho where he met a transvestite called Lola, which is fine. And I have no problem with that, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be fine. But they did object to the use of the words Coca-Cola. So Ray Davis, in fact, had to fly back from New York and re-record the words Cherry Cola.
Cherry, that's right.
So, you know, it was just that sort of stuff that you thought was... Did anyone care?
Yeah.
I mean, they banned a record by George Hamilton IV, the old permatanned country singer or whatever.
I know,
And he had a reference in the record to a rose and a baby Ruth, which they banned because a baby Ruth was an American chocolate bar, albeit not available in this country.
No.
So there's a whole audience in this country not knowing what the hell he's singing about and not knowing why it was banned anyway. So, you know, it did get carried away. And then, you know, the whole sort of Beatles things and lots of drugs references that they were obviously not going to... You know, they read things into Day in the Life.
And of course, there was their infamous Butcher album cover.
The Butcher's,
as well.
Yesterday and Today, the American album sleeve, which is photographed in London, bizarrely. And it had them in white sort of butcher's smocks and holding cuts of meat and dismembered dolls.
Yeah, how did that come to be? Because it was very out of character with what they were doing, really.
It was a photographer's idea.
Okay. Yeah.
And particularly Lennon never liked the pretty, let's all pose as four pretty boys for a record cover.
Sure, yeah.
And that's what they'd sort of done up until then. Or they'd done a couple of fisheye lens things, you know. But it was, and they'd done the revolver sleeve, which was the artwork.
Yeah.
But effectively, you know, they had always been photographed as a sort of happy toothsome foursome.
That's
And Lennon, you know, really didn't like any of this stuff. So the idea of doing this thing, which was sort of off the wall, appealed to him. George Harrison hated it. I thought it was quite unpleasant. And of course, it was for an American album, so they didn't think because
it would match.
Yesterday and Today, in America, they made compilations that never came out in this country,
right?
Because that's how they worked it. So Yesterday and Today was a compilation album released only in America. And they saw the sleeve somewhere. I don't know. I mean, it was obviously organised by the Beatles and Epstein, and Capitol Records in America put it on the sleeve. And within 24 hours, it was removed from the shops and from the record.
Yeah.
It was absolute uproar.
Yes.
And became known as the Butcher's Sleeve, and was replaced by a picture of four of them sitting in a sort of sailor's, what used to be a trunk, you know, a big trunk you took on a boat.
Yeah.
And there they were, the smiling foursome again, which is what John hated. So, you know, it just came about because I think they got fed up with being the Beatles and looking, you know, they wanted to do things that were a bit different. Like, you know, the Sergeant Pepper sleeve.
Yeah.
You know, Sir Joseph Lockwood, the chairman of EMI, had to come in and stop them putting Gandhi and Adolf Hitler on it, you know. and then, of course, you know, the two virgins with John and Yoko naked, which may have been a step too far for all of us, I think.
Possibly. I think the one that amuses me the most, really, is Cliff Richard and Honky Tonk Angel.
We could have told him. We could have headed that one off at the pass, but we saw record sales. wasn't it?
He basically issued a song that he didn't have a clue what he was actually singing about.
Yeah. We knew what it was about at the record company. We weren't going to tell him because we thought, you know, this is a hit record. We saw the old pound signs coming up, so no one was going to tell Cliff it was about an American prostitute.
That's right.
Honky Tonk Angel is a nickname for a prostitute, particularly in the southern states of America.
And he ended up banning himself.
He did. It apparently arrived at some religious meeting he went to where a girl in the audience put her hand up and said, Cliff, what are you doing making a record about a prostitute? And he got no idea what she was talking about. So then he went back and we basically had to withdraw the record because he wouldn't promote it.
He
was due to go, ironically, I think the day after or 2 days later, he was due to go on the Russell Harty show on television and sing it, and he wouldn't.
Right.
He went on, but he wouldn't sing it.
Right. Okay.
So he was one of the few acts to sort of ban himself.
Amazing. Well, I actually sat there and read your book last night. It's a fascinating read.
Thank you.
And not only is it a fascinating read, but it's also like a reference book, really, because it's written like a timeline, isn't it?
It starts
in the 1930s, ends in the current day, really. And even Princess Margaret gets a mention in there, doesn't she?
Yeah, she quite liked a bit of rock and roll, Maggie, old Princess Maggie. And I'm trying to remember without going through my notes. I think it was the West Midlands Dance Association or similar.
The Midlands Dance Teachers Association.
That's right. I come from the Midlands. Yes. There's nothing to do with me. The Midlands Dancers, they objected and criticised Princess Margaret because she had spoken up in favour of rock and roll and jiving and thought it was jolly good fun.
Yeah.
And they thought it was the sort of thing that nice girls did not do.
Right.
I never met any nice girls, so I don't know. So good for her. And of course, the great story is that the Queen had a private viewing of... the Bill Haley film.
Rock Around the Clock.
Rock Around the Clock.
She
had a private viewing of that in Balmoral.
Oh, okay. Do you know if she approved?
We don't know
not?
What she
no,
thought of
no.
it. No, because it was obviously out there in the streets, and there were punch-ups, and you know, teddy boys, and whatever else. So she presumably wanted to keep herself abreast of what was going on. You know, I did. One of the great stories I found out is that there was all sorts of violence going on in cinemas up and down the country, and various people told me that people read that there were a couple of punch-ups in London, and then there was a punch-up in Birmingham. So people in Manchester thought, oh well, whatever. A punch up too, and it sort of spread like wildfire. And I went back through the archives of the Essex Chronicle in the library in Chelmsford, thinking, you know, I wonder what happened. And it was shown in Chelmsford in the old days. There used to be two independent cinemas called the Pavilion and the Select, which are owned by a guy called George Watkins. And it was on at one of those. I can't remember which one now. And in the week leading up to the film Rock Around the Clock being shown, there was a story that George Watkins had hired a bunch of former soldiers to be on duty on the night he showed it in order to sort of quell any trouble or punch-ups.
Okay.
And they interviewed this sort of sergeant major going, you know, I would deal with all stuff, you know. And the next week, there's a story that no one turned up. I mean, four people went and there was no punch-up, you know. I did actually find someone who went to the cinema to see it.
Amazing.
And, you know, so Chelmsford was behind the times in punch-ups, I'm afraid.
Well, there's one more story I need to hear about, Brian, and this is Roger Daltrey and his stuttering.
Oh, right, yes, the very famous... Fade Away.
Yes.
Which, it came from something that they developed in the studio. There was a blues singer who they liked, who had this particular style of stuttering and stammering, which they developed for this particular record.
Yeah, Sonny Boy Williamson, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And then, of course, when we heard it, we all went, what's coming next? Fade Away. But, of course, there were people who objected to it, and it was banned at some, or not played at radio, because it might cause offence to people who had a stammer and a stutter. I suspect that the people who had a stammer and a stutter hopefully enjoyed the record just as much. I don't think it was meant in any way of an insult. I mean, it was in tribute to Sonny Boy Williamson and a style of singing. And it worked. I mean, it's, you know, it was... We still talk about it today.
Absolutely.
You know,
The reason I asked that is that I saw a review on Amazon last night of your book
from
a reader who described Band on the Run as flipping excellent.
Okay. I thank
you. So it's probably a reference to Roger Daltrey. You can't get much better than that.
No. Pictures of Lily we could go into with Who, but we won't go into on daytime radio.
No, we'll leave that one alone. Well done. Now, your book, Band on the Run, it's published as an e-book at the moment, at what seems like a very reasonable £4.50. Where can we get it, Brian?
I have no idea. I don't understand technology. No, this has been done through a friend and a colleague of mine called David Roberts, who runs a company called Pop Publishing, and he and I have known each other. each other for many years. He was the editor of the Guinness Book of Hit Albums and Singles for years, which is how I know him.
Yeah.
And he said, why don't we do some books? Because we've both published books, proper books. And why don't we do a few titles for as e-books?
Yeah.
You know, the publishing world at the moment in book trade is having a tough time, a bit like the record business. So they're getting a bit picky about the titles that they do. It's getting harder to get books done. So we've got a couple of titles, two or three titles that we have been playing with for years and, you know, working out how to do. One of them was Band on the Run. So we decided that we would do it as an e-book, which he did. I've no idea how he did it. I can't even get access to it because I don't have access to e-books. So my wife does, but I don't. I just get books out of the library and buy them. You know, I'm an old-fashioned book reader.
Yeah.
So technology is beyond me. I've never downloaded a record in my life.
Really?
I don't know how to. I have records, I have albums, I have CDs, and I have books, and that's a part of being old, I suppose.
Well,
so you can get it from Amazon,
and
Kindle and stuff like that, I believe.
Well, I'm going to post our whole conversation up on our website later on, I'll also include a link to where you can download.
I'll try it and see what comes up.
Okay.
Because normally I turn up for interviews with a copy of the book.
Okay, yeah.
And this time I've turned up with a copy of 24 pages, you know.
Well, you haven't had to refer to any of it. It must all still be in the grey matter up there.
The weird thing is I have an extraordinary memory. I didn't know I had an extraordinary memory, but I do. I can remember, you know, way back to the first interview with The Who.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you'd necessarily forget it.
No.
But I can.
It would stick with you.
And, weird things, you know, like Zoot Money threatening to, you know, you know, having a fight with Zoot Money backstage at Chelmsford, you know, when I interviewed him. You know. So, these things are stuck with.
Well, Brian, I've much enjoyed talking to you today. It's been fascinating. Thanks for coming in. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Before you go, could I ask you to introduce the next record?
Depends on what it is.
Well, what do you think it is?
Now you've thrown me. I have no idea.
What's the name of your book?
Oh, Band on the Run.
Yay!
There you go. Has someone else used it?